If you sign with their merchandising company and get $5,000 under the deal, does the record label get 15% of that? First of all, congrats if you thought of this question before you heard it. Second, why should the record company be making money on both sides of the deal when the active rights money and the passive money both go into the same parent company's pocket? Third, get ready for disappointment. Labels argue they're entitled to this money because they are playing two different roles, for example, record company and merchandiser, and therefore should be paid for each. They argue, correctly, that if you made a merchandising deal with someone else, the merchandiser would make money for what they do, and the record label would get their passive money as well, so you're in the same boat. And why should they be penalized? What they don't tell you is that the affiliate company has a separate profit center from the record company. That means the record company executives don't get a bonus if your merchandising soars unless you give them 360 rights to the merch income. With some clout, you can get rid of the record company's passive obligation if you sign with an affiliated company. But if you can't do this, try to reduce the 360 percentage. For example, if your deal gives the record label 15% of your merchandising money, maybe you only pay them 5% or 10% if the deal is with an affiliated company. If you're on the fast track and haven't decided to leave the music business, go to Chapter 11. Everyone else, forward ho. If you don't understand what that means, it means you skip the instructions at the end of Chapter 1. It also means you never read the directions when you buy a new electronic device. Chapter 10. Other major deal points. The other major things you'll want to know about your record deal are how much and how long. The how much part of this doesn't mean royalties and advances, which we already discussed, but rather the number of masters you have to record. The how long part means the period of time that the deal lasts, which sounds pretty straightforward, but has taken some strange twists over the years. Amount of product. Commitments versus options. Record deals are traditionally structured with the company having the smallest obligation it can negotiate, while keeping the option to get as much product as possible. For example, a company may commit to record a few tracks or an album of an artist, then have the option to require an additional 4 or 5 albums, each one at the company's election. Albums to which the company is committed are called firm albums. The others are called optional or option albums. As we discussed in Chapter 9, the whole concept of how much product an artist delivers is changing. As of this writing, we haven't settled on a new norm, and most companies are still writing deals based on albums, even though they privately acknowledge it will be unrealistic to do this in the future. One major label is already shifting its contracts to a specific number of masters rather than albums, but the others have yet to follow. So while the next section could be well out of date by the time you hear this, at the moment, it's still the way most deals are structured. Options in new artist deals. With new artists, companies like to commit to a few tracks, an EP, or maybe one album. However, the major companies want the right to get a total of 5 to 6 albums over the course of the deal. Indies will often agree to a maximum of 3 or 4, sometimes even less. This is an improvement over the past. Companies used to insist on options for 8 to 10 albums. The company wants the right to these optional albums one at a time. With a lot of clout, you can sometimes make them take 2 at a time, called 2 firm in industry lingo. But this has become harder for new artists. And if you get it at all, it will most likely be later in the deal. For example, they can pick up albums 2 and 3 individually, but if they go on with the deal, they have to take 4 and 5 as a package. Can't hurt to ask for this, but don't take it personally if you don't get it. If you have a lot of heat and the company does commit to 2 albums from the get-go, it may ask for the right to bail out if the first album tanks. For example, if the first album sells less than 150,000 units in the United States, based on STEAs and sales, refer to Chapter 9 for what that means. The company is no longer committed to the second album. Or you could get to the same place by stating it another way. The second album is optional, but the company is required to exercise its option if the first album generates the equivalent of 150,000 units. As we'll discuss in a bit, I'm talking here about the number of newly recorded studio albums, meaning recorded in a studio, you'll have to deliver. This does not include live albums, which we'll see later in this chapter. Greatest hits albums, also later in this chapter. Specialty albums, Christmas, Easter, polka parade. Side projects, duets, because you're not the featured artist, or the like. Options in mid-range and superstar deals. If you're scoring high on the Hedometer and lots of hounds are chasing you, the company may commit to two albums firm and get options for additional albums. Each option would require them to record one or two albums. Even if they actually commit to two albums, however, as just noted, they may want the right to bail out if the first album tanks. It's rare that a company doesn't have the right to at least four albums from this level of artist, and five is the norm. At the superstar level, deals of only three albums are possible, and at least two of those albums are typically firm. A few huge artists, and at the other end, a hot new artist signing to an indie label, have made deals for one album only, but this is rare. Options aren't good for you. I remember a friend of mine from the high school choir who came in one day jubilant because she had signed a 10-album deal with Capitol Records. In reality, it turned out to be a deal for only one single, and she had merely given Capitol the option to require up to 10 albums. While my friend faded from the music biz after recording that one single, her attitude was not unusual. Many artists still think that record company options are good for them. The numbers are so high at the end. But in fact, options are only good for the record company. If you're a flop, you'll never see the money. If you're a success, it'll probably be less than you're worth. So train yourself to think of options as nothing more than a chance for the record company to get out of your deal. They are never good for you. Making the best of options. Despite my high-minded speech, the reality is that you have to live with options at all but major heat and superstar levels. This industry custom is too well entrenched to buck. However, since you're giving the company a chance to drop you after each album or two, in other words, to protect their rear ends if there's no success, I think you're entitled to more goodies if they keep you. This can be done in two different ways. Royalties. For optional albums, you should get better royalties. Typically, the increase is around 0.5% to 1%, both in your basic rate and in any escalated rates. For example, I did a mid-level deal that looked like the one noted in the PDF. Funds. You should also get increased recording funds for optional albums. I earlier cited an example of a new artist deal in the PDF. And also in the PDF are the numbers from a mid-level deal. Don't the numbers look delicious in the later option periods? What a great deal. What a genius negotiator. Don't be fooled. Options are never good for you. They only mean you'll get dropped if you're not worth the price, or you'll get too little if you're a smash. So repeat after me. Options are never good for me. Now, write it on the blackboard 25 times. Pay or play. So you have a deal for an album. Let's hit the studio, right? Well, not so fast, partner. Virtually no record deal ever requires the company to actually make a record. Huh? Yep. And this is not only true for new artists, but also for mid-level ones and superstars. Almost all contracts contain a provision that says the company, instead of recording an album, can merely pay you a sum of money equal to, in the first draft of their agreement, minimum union scale for an album. Refer back to Chapter 8 for what union scale means. Or, after negotiating, either the difference between the recording fund and the cost of the last album, or a pre-negotiated set fee. This is called a pay-or-play provision, meaning, as the name implies, that the record company has the option either to allow you to play your music or to pay you off. The amount you get for pay-or-play is negotiable. Ideally, you want to get your recording fund, less the recording costs of your last album. That's what you'd make if you actually recorded an album and it stiffed, which could only happen because the company didn't do their job, of course. Sometimes the company will agree to that amount, but with a floor and ceiling. We discussed this in Chapter 9. Or sometimes it's just a negotiated amount. Apart from beating them up for the most pay-or-play money you can get, you also want to be sure that, once they pay you off, the deal is over. This shouldn't be hard to get, but it isn't in a lot of form agreements, and without it, the company could hold on to you without making records. On the other hand, since they don't want your records, they probably don't want you around either. But it's cheap insurance to add language making sure. How long? Term. How long the record company keeps you under an exclusive agreement is called the term of your deal. Record deals used to be for a term of 1 year, with options to renew for additional periods of 1 year each. These segments of the term are also called terms, or sometimes periods, such as the initial term, first year, first option period, second year, etc. In the olden days, an artist was usually obligated to deliver 2 albums during each year. That worked terrifically back when records were banged out like pancakes, since most of the time, artists just showed up, sang, then went to the beach. As we discussed, in those days it was not unusual to make an album in a few weeks. Every contract is a history lesson, and the contractual language dealing with the length of deals has a particularly colorful past. Behind each clause is a story that ends with, "I'm going to write something that makes sure, if this ever happens again, I won't get shafted." And unraveling these bits of history can be fun, so let's take a look. Late delivery of albums. As artists took more creative control, albums took longer to make. Indeed, the more successful the artist, the longer, with rare exception, the recording process. Today, for pop artists, periods of years between albums are not unusual for superstars, or for flakes at any level. Many reasons for this are legitimate. If an album is successful, you need to be out touring and promoting it, which means you can't be in the studio. In fact, the more successful it is, the longer you'll be out touring and promoting, and the record company won't even want you to start the next album. Hip-hop is a totally different story, as we'll discuss in a minute. Unfortunately, many of these delays don't have such a noble purpose. I'm convinced, but can't prove, that one of the reasons for delay is that artists, particularly following a major success, are a bit frightened to put out their next record. When it's actually released, they have to find out whether it does as well as the prior one. Until then, it's only speculation, and their fabulous track record stays intact. So they continue to fine-tune, tweak, poke, re-record, rethink, etc., which delays the day of reckoning. And second albums are particularly troublesome. If you think about it, someone's first album can actually be 5 years or more in the making. That's because they were accumulating songs for a long time before they ever got a record deal, and thus had a huge catalog to choose from in making the first album. However, when an artist gets to the second album, all the cherries have been picked, so it's a matter of writing new material or going into the second tier of old stuff. And this process has to take place within a year or two, so you don't lose the momentum of the first album. That's in stark contrast to the unlimited time that preceded the first album. so there's much more pressure on the second go-round. Record companies historically solve this slow delivery problem by having the right to extend the term of the agreement if an album wasn't delivered on time. In other words, if your album was 6 months late, the current one-year term of your deal was extended by 6 months. This worked terrifically until Olivia Newton-John filed a suit against MCA Records seeking termination of her agreement. The case site is MCA Records, Inc. versus Newton-John, 90 California Appeals, 3rd District, 18, 1979. For you technical freaks who like to read court cases. In this case, she argued that her deal should be limited to the actual number of years stated in the contract, without regard to any extensions. In other words, since her contract was for a 2-year term with 3 1-year options, a total of 5 years, she argued that MCA couldn't enforce the deal beyond 5 years from the start date, even if she hadn't given them all the product due. To everyone's surprise, the court sort of agreed. It reduced the duration of MCA's injunction, meaning the court order that said she couldn't record for anyone else, to the 5 years, rather than allowing any extensions. However, I said sort of, because the 5 years weren't over at the time of the case, and so the court technically didn't deal with the issue in full. Nonetheless, the case's language was strong enough to make all the companies nervous, and it forever changed the way record contracts are drawn. The result was that, since the Newton-John case, the terms of record deals have not been stated in specific time periods, like 1 or 2 years. Instead, the contracts say each period ends 12 months after release of the last album required for that period, but that the term is no less than a specified minimum, e.g., 18 months, from the time it starts. For example, if you're required to record one album, the period might start upon signing your deal and end 12 months after release of that album, but no sooner than 18 months after signing. This method of fixing the term of a deal based on delivery of albums has worked swimmingly for many years. But as we've been discussing, the nature of what's going to be delivered under record deals is changing. Albums certainly won't be the only thing required, assuming albums even survive at all in the age of single-song streaming. So how will the term be figured in the future? Will it be just a number of masters instead of albums? If so, will those masters be delivered in bunches, or 1 or 2 at a time? And how often will the company want them? At the time I'm writing this, there's no consensus on how this should work, though, as I noted earlier, one major label has already moved to contractual periods based on a number of masters, rather than an album, for each period of the term. But the other labels still use albums, meaning they basically have their fingers in their ears while singing, "La la la, I can't hear you." Interestingly, publishing deals, which are deals for songwriters, were also based on albums historically, but they've changed their model even more radically, as we'll discuss in Chapter 18. Here's another interesting aspect. All the deals made in the last few years, including for superstars, end after delivery of a number of albums. But if no one wants albums anymore, how do you ever get out of the deal? Just deliver an album, even though you know the company and the marketplace don't want it? The answer is that each deal will have to be renegotiated when a new norm sets in. But the company and artist won't necessarily agree on what to do. In essence, the industry pretty much punted, deciding that we'll have to figure it out when we get there. Whether it's based on a number of albums or a number of masters, record contracts don't end until a certain period of time following delivery of the last required product. This concept nicely solved the Olivia Newton-John problem, but the companies needed to add additional provisions to deal with this little snippet of history. In 1970, Dean Martin signed an agreement with Warner Records. The agreement was unusual for those days, although it's the norm today, because the term continued until delivery of all the albums. About 6 years later, after everyone had forgotten about him, Dino came in and announced he was about to start recording a new album, for which he expected the substantial amount of money required in the contract. This sent Warner into a tizzy, since Mr. Martin's star was not of the same brightness as when he signed the deal, and they began scrambling to find a way out. So Dino sued them. Ultimately, the case was settled, but it taught the companies a lesson. Contracts shouldn't be geared only to delivery of albums, or else they can go on forever. Because of this, you'll now find contractual provisions that say companies can get out of a deal if the artist doesn't deliver an album within a certain period of time after delivery of the previous album. I'm going to use the term album because it's simpler, but the concept applies equally to a specified number of masters, if that's how the deal is written. In other words, if you're late more than a certain amount of time, usually 12 to 18 months, depending on bargaining power, they can terminate your deal. But they don't have to whack you. Even if you're late, if they want to keep you under the deal, they can sit back and wait. On top of the right to terminate, record companies also have the right to reduce your advance on the next album. For example, a common provision reduces your advance by 5% for every month that you're late. Note, this is 5% of the recording fund, not just the difference between costs and the fund, which would be the money you keep. So being late could eat up your entire in-pocket advance. For example, if your recording fund is $100,000 and it will cost you $90,000 to record, you have $10,000 for yourself. The 5% penalty, however, applies to the $100,000, meaning a $5,000 reduction for every month you're late, meaning your pocket money is gone after only 2 months. And of course, this also reduces what's left for recording costs. Here's how we try to soften this penalty. 1. The 5% reduction only applies to unpaid monies, not anything you already got. The form agreement will say 5% of the entire fund, which includes monies you got when you started recording, as well as recording costs. So, for example, if you got $25,000 when you started recording, and there's $75,000 left to pay, the 5% reduction only applies to the $75,000, not the full $100,000. 2. If there's a formula for the fund, as we discussed in Chapter 9, try to say that the reduction can't take you below the minimum of the formula. Of course, if this album's fund is only the minimum under the formula, that means there's no reduction. Labels don't like this. They want something that will hurt if you're late. Apart from the financial penalty, as we first discussed, the form contract also says that the label can get out of the deal if you're late. We try to soften this by saying the company can't terminate your deal unless you're more than 6 months late. They can still reduce the advance, starting on the date you're late, but they can't bail on you completely for a few more months. So, because of Dean and Olivia, A, the term goes on until you deliver, and B, you're shafted if you deliver late. Does that take care of everything? Not quite. Next comes a history lesson from Frank Zappa. You probably wouldn't think Zappa was the guy to first anticipate hip-hop practices, but Mr. Zappa had a 4-album deal with Warner Records and badly wanted out. So one day he showed up with 4 albums tucked under his arm and announced he was delivering all the remaining product required under his deal. Thus, says Mr. Z, I'm now free to sign with another label. Warner was not thrilled. The Zappa lesson is now handled by stating that you can't even start recording an album until you've delivered the prior album, and that the new album can't be delivered sooner than 6 months after delivery of the prior album. This was legitimate enough in the past. Historically, you couldn't really market more than one album at a time, and if an artist put an album on the shelf for later release, when it finally came out, it could well be out of touch with the current taste of the music biz, which can change hourly. But in today's hip-hop world, more is better, meaning artists release multiple albums at once, and these albums can have 20 or more tracks. And often these batches are released very close to each other. Wherever Mr. Zappa is, he's probably smiling. In the same way that the album concept is still included in record deals, there's no norm for this kind of Blizzard delivery yet. As a practical matter, the companies just sit and figure it out with each artist, depending on the situation. But it's still the Wild West, at least until a new norm emerges. I suspect all the labels will follow the one major that's converted to a number of masters rather than albums. But whatever happens, it's gonna be interesting. Delivery requirements. Apart from the number of recordings, contracts also talk about the kind of recordings you can deliver. Delivery is a magic word because it means more than dumping the stuff on their doorstep, ringing the doorbell, and running off. It means, A, you have to deliver a bunch of other junk along with the recordings, artwork, licenses for the songs, deals with producers, etc. And, B, the company has to accept the recordings as complying with your deal. Your contract will specify what standards the company can use in deciding whether to accept the recordings, and the definition of these standards depends on your bargaining power. The extremes are commercially satisfactory. If your contract says you must deliver commercially satisfactory recordings, it means the record company only has to take recordings it believes will do well in the market. In other words, recordings it finds satisfactory for commercial exploitation. Translation, recordings it likes. If your contract has this language and they don't like your records, then A, at best, they send you back to the studio at your expense, or B, at worst, they say you haven't delivered the product required by your deal, which means you're late, in breach of your contract, and they can reduce your advance and/or terminate the deal. Technically satisfactory. At the other end of the spectrum is technically satisfactory. If you only have to deliver technically satisfactory recordings, then as long as a recording is technically well made, the company has to take it. Technically satisfactory delivery standards are very rare today because of abuses that I'm sure you can imagine. For example, one of my record company clients got an album that was supposed to be a secret group of superstars, but turned out to be a previously released flop from an unknown group. Newer artists can expect to live with commercially satisfactory. Mid-range artists may get a technically satisfactory standard, but it will be subject to the companies approving the songs and the producer, plus the same limits described in the next two sentences. Superstars can expect an even more favorable version of technically satisfactory. The company may not have any approvals, but it will have language saying the recordings must be of a style and perhaps even a quality similar to your previous recordings. They will also exclude any specialty or novelty recordings, so you can't give them a children's record, Christmas record, the Johnny Mathis songbook, unless, of course, you are Johnny Mathis, Gregorian chants, etc. Other delivery criteria. The other requirements for your recordings, regardless of your level, are that they must be 1. Studio recordings, as opposed to live concert recordings. 2. Recorded during the term, to keep you from pulling out those old garage recordings. 3. Songs not previously recorded by you or someone else. I'm sure you can figure out the history lesson behind this one. 4. Recordings that feature only your performance, to keep you from bringing in the kids and your Aunt Sally as guest soloists. 5. Not wholly instrumental selections, unless you're an instrumentalist. 6. Material that doesn't cause the company any legal hassles, such as infringing somebody's copyright, defaming someone, or using obscene language, to the extent that's still possible. 7. Songs of a minimum playing time, usually 2 minutes. In addition, you also have to deliver all the legal rights they need to exploit your recordings, such as producer agreements, we'll talk about those in Chapter 11, licenses to use the songs, Chapter 16, and sample clearances. We'll talk about samples in Chapter 17. Guaranteed release. As we discussed earlier in this chapter, very few record contracts even build in an obligation to record your records, much less a commitment to release them. With even a little bargaining power, and with some companies, as a matter of practice, you can get a guaranteed release, which is also called a release commitment. Bizarrely, this clause will never obligate the company to release your records. It will, however, let you get out of the deal if they don't. With more bargaining power, you can sometimes get the right to buy back the unreleased album. After all, if the company doesn't think enough of it to put it out, why not let you take it elsewhere and get their money back? Guaranteed release clauses basically turn you into a notice factory. If, within a certain period after delivery, usually 90 to 120 days, the company hasn't put out your album, you have earned the right to give it a written notice saying, "You haven't put out my album." After receiving this shocking news, the company has another period, usually 60 days, within which to actually put out the album, if they feel like it. If they don't, you now have the privilege of sending a second notice, usually within 30 days after the 60 days, and if you're late, you lose your rights. The notice says the company has still failed to put out your album, that you really meant it when you said you wanted them to, and that you are now terminating the deal. At this point, you can say goodbye. But note that the company still doesn't have to put out the record. By the way, the period after delivery in which the company must release is usually extended if any of it falls between October 15th and January 15th. This is because, for the most part, no one other than the major stars release product after October 15th. Beginning in early December, the radio stations start thinking about Hawaii, Aspen, or St. Bart's, and they freeze their playlists, meaning they add no new records until after January 15th. In response, the record industry closes up around the middle of December. If an artist isn't well known, their record doesn't have time to make its climb before the December shutdown, so everyone has to wait until next year. Thus, the record companies want to extend their release commitment period to make way for this practice, and to make way for their vacations. All of this may change as streaming becomes more dominant than radio, but for now, this clause still lives. Guaranteed release clauses only let you out of your record deal if the company doesn't release your record in the United States. As your bargaining power increases, as well as your international fame, you may be able to negotiate a similar release provision for foreign territories. Certainly, you should try to get a guaranteed release in the major territories. See the beginning of Chapter 12 for what they are, and any place else where you sell big numbers. Normally, you can't get out of the entire deal for failure to release outside the United States. You can only terminate for the particular territory where they blew it, and only for the specific album not released. So you can get another distributor to release that album in the territory. However, without massive clout, you won't actually get back the territory. Instead, you'll get the right to find another company to license the unreleased album from your record company. Your company will credit 50% of what it gets from this license to your account and keep the other 50% for themselves. If you keep pushing, the company may agree that if it fails to release two consecutive albums in a particular territory, you can have back that territory for the rest of the deal. While this isn't likely to be meaningful, if you're that much of a stiff in the territory, odds are no one else will want you. It's better than a sharp stick in the eye. As the CD's heartbeat slows, an interesting twist to guaranteed releases is starting to poke out its head. Namely, can the record company satisfy its guaranteed release requirement by just sticking your songs on a streaming service? That's certainly not the spirit of these clauses, as they historically required the company's financial commitment to press CDs, ship them to stores, and do some level of marketing. There was rarely a contractual marketing commitment, but if the company wanted to see any of their money back, they had to give it a go. However, the company forms don't define the term release, so dropping songs online would technically do it. The real goal is to have them market your music with some amount of energy, though that's hard to quantify in any meaningful way, especially if they hate your record. If you have some heat, however, you can sometimes get a guaranteed marketing commitment or an agreement to spend a certain amount to promote your records. Whatever's in the contract, you have to hope they will want to get back their investment in you, so your interests should be aligned. Spoiler alert. From the beginning of the business, almost every artist feels their company should be doing more. Controlled compositions. Historically, one of the most important provisions of your record deal was the controlled composition clause, which limits how much you get paid as a songwriter. Due to some changes in the copyright law, this has become much less important. But unfortunately, it hasn't become that much less complicated. And to understand it, you need a pretty extensive knowledge of publishing, which we're going to discuss later. So let's put it off until you have more background info. If you really can't wait, refer to the Controlled Composition Clauses section of Chapter 17. But you'll get pretty confused if you don't have a decent grasp on publishing. If you're on the Advanced Overview track, skip straight to Chapter 11. Experts, straight on. Greatest Hits. A Greatest Hits album, also called a Best Of, is a compilation of songs from your prior albums. I've always been amused by the term Greatest Hits, since the album is sometimes neither. Greatest Hits albums are on the Endangered Species list, somewhere between the Hawksbill Turtle and the Black-Footed Ferret. As streaming has soared, Greatest Hits albums have nosedived, and the reason is pretty simple. Everyone is essentially making their own Greatest Hits by creating playlists on streaming services. However, record company contracts still want the right to make Greatest Hits albums, even though there really isn't anything they can do with them. If you don't say anything, the company will put out as many Greatest Hits albums as it likes, whenever it likes. You should add a provision in your contract that requires the label to get your consent before they can release a Greatest Hits album, so you can approve the tracks and artwork. If you can't get that, at least get some limitation on what they can do, such as allowing one Greatest Hits album for every three albums you deliver, or one during the term and one after. There used to be advances for Greatest Hits albums. Those days are gone, since there's no longer any market for this product, with the exception of a cousin of the Greatest Hits album called The Box Set, which we'll discuss in detail in Chapter 12. Live albums. A live album is recorded during a live concert, with lots of screaming and applause, rather than in a studio. Their popularity goes through periodic ups and downs, sort of like musical movies. They were historically something a company did to keep the artist happy, because they didn't really make any money. Then, in 1976, Peter Frampton broke all the rules with an album called Frampton Comes Alive, which was not only a live album, but also a double live album. Double albums were a traditional handicap at retail because they're more expensive. The album sold multi-millions of copies and blew out all the traditional wisdom. After the predictable glut of live albums following Mr. Frampton's, the live album popularity again faded and currently is at a level I'd call eh. People who want live music now mostly go to YouTube or the concert festival websites. Unless you've got a lot of muscle, record companies won't let you deliver a live album, or even one live cut on a studio album, without their consent. On rare occasions, superstars can get the right to deliver one live album during the term of their deal, but it'll usually have a reduced advance, both because of live records' dicey sales history and the fact that most of the songs have been previously released. Independence Day. When the music biz started its decline in the year 2000, deals with independent record companies became more prevalent. That's because independent labels became more prevalent. How come? I like to think it's because majors don't always understand the kind of cool music that indies love. There are, though, a couple of other reasons. People laid off by big companies in the downturn started indie labels, and indies are happy with smaller numbers because they make smaller bets, and therefore don't need to score as big as the majors to do well. I think the spread of indies is incredibly healthy for the biz. It's like the record industry in the 1960s, when independent labels like A&M, Chrysalis, and Island changed the face of music. Great music has always come from doing things out of the mainstream. Keep at it. As the independents grow stronger, however, their deals look more and more like major label deals. But there are some differences you should understand, so let's take a look. We'll start with true independence. Refer to Chapter 7 for what that means. Then mosey on over to major distributed independents that have little or no staff and rely on a major label to do the heavy lifting. True independence. 1. As we already noted, you get less of an advance from an independent. Because a deal with them is like shopping in the bargain basement, you should make up for it by giving them the lowest number of albums possible. A few years ago, it wasn't hard to limit independent deals to one or two albums. Lately, as the independents' muscles grew, so did their desire for more albums. So now they try to get as many as 5. See if you can keep it down to 3 or 4. As a general rule, the less money they're guaranteeing, the fewer albums they should get. And with a smaller deal, you can often limit them to 2 or 3. 2. If you're willing to take a very small or 0 advance, some labels will give you 50% of their profits instead of a royalty. We'll discuss how profits are computed later in Chapter 14. For now, take my word that a profit share means a lot more money if you're a big success, though it could mean less money at mid-level. 3. Most indie labels don't have overseas operations, and therefore you want to make sure that your records get released in those territories. If they're not released, you should get back the rights to those territories. Refer to the discussion of this earlier in this chapter. Sometimes you can even limit their rights to the United States only and make your own foreign deals. 4. Most independents, just like majors, want 360 rights. Refer to earlier in this chapter in the guaranteed release section for what those are. They may also want to own some or all of your publishing, your earnings as a songwriter, as opposed to your earnings as a performer on records. Since we haven't discussed publishing, I want to defer the ins and outs of this until we do. The way to protect yourself is in the pop quiz section of Chapter 18 if you want to look ahead, but I suggest you do it only if you understand publishing pretty well. Major distributed independence. When you're recording for a major distributed company that isn't a true independent, you have the same concerns we just discussed, plus a few added goodies. Some of these companies have an overall deal with a distributor for all their product, while others just make a deal with a major for each artist they sign, one at a time. If your company doesn't have an overall distribution deal with a distributor, you have to ask whether this company can get anyone to distribute your album. As we discussed back in Chapter 7, it's not that hard to get your music out digitally, but of course, you could do that yourself. The idea is to get a real distributor, with marketing skills and staff, behind your music. If you have some clout, you should say that the company must enter into an agreement with a major distributor to make sure it's a legit distributor. In addition, and even if the company doesn't agree to a major distributor, you want to say that the indie has to make a distribution deal within a certain period of time, such as 6 months after the execution of the contract or completion of your album, though I've gone as long as 9 to 12 months. If the time period is measured from completion of your album, be sure you have an outside date. Otherwise, if the company never records you, the date will never arrive. For example, you might require a company to make an agreement within 6 months after completion of your album, but in no event later than 12 months after execution of your deal. If they don't use a major distributor, you want to approve who it is. Assuming the independent agrees, it will say you must be reasonable in your approval. So you can't use this clause to get out of the deal when some prettier face dangles more money in front of you. You wouldn't do that, would you? And by the way, when I represent the independent, I insist that the artist pre-approve all the likely distributors, which I then list. Watch out for this one. Suppose your deal with the independent is for 2 albums firm, but the distributor drops the company and you after 1 album. How do you make sure the company doesn't hold you for the 2nd album? Historically, part of your protection is a guaranteed release. If they don't put your album out, you can terminate the deal. Refer back to the guaranteed release section earlier in this chapter. But nowadays, that just means slapping your masters online, so it's not much protection. Also, as you'll remember from the section on amount of product earlier in this chapter, companies don't even have to make a record to hang on to your contract. And if they don't record any product, the guaranteed release never comes into play. Knowing this, various sleazeballs in our business have sunk their teeth into an artist and not let go if they smelled that somebody might pay them for the privilege. The way to cover yourself is to say that the independent has 6 to 12 months after a distribution deal lapses within which to get a new deal, or else you're out. Chapter 11. Producer and Mixer Deals. What's a producer? Traditionally, a record producer combines the roles of director and producer in the motion picture field. He or she is responsible for bringing the creative product into tangible form, a recording, which means A, being responsible for maximizing the creative process, finding and selecting songs, deciding on arrangements, getting the right vocal sound, etc., and B, administering the whole project, such as booking studios, hiring musicians, staying within a budget, filing union reports, etc. The mechanical aspects of administration, actually calling the musicians, doing the paperwork, etc., are often handled by a production coordinator, whose life purpose is to make things happen. In the pop/EDM/hip-hop world, there are a number of producers who produce only tracks, meaning everything except the vocals. These tracks can be made to order for a specific artist, or often these folks produce tracks without any particular artist in mind, then sell them to the highest bidder. It's also common for an artist to record a song with a producer, decide not to use it, and then let the producer remove the artist's vocal and use the track for someone else. If you get this kind of track, then you would then get a vocal producer who, not surprisingly, produces the vocals to finish the track, sort of like building a burrito at Chipotle. The history of producers. As we discussed earlier, artists in the 1950s were mostly people who just showed up to sing, then left to do lunch. My friend Snuff Garrett, one of the most important producers of the 50s and 60s, considered it burdensome if it took him more than 5 days to record an album, and the artist wasn't even there for the whole time. Using this technique, Snuff produced records for Cher, Sonny and Cher, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Bobby V, Del Shannon, and a host of other successes, including such strange choices as Telly Savalas and Walter Brennan. Snuff started out, as did all the early producers, as an A&R man. The letters stand for artists, and repertoire. A&R men, in those days there were no A&R persons, were executives of record companies whose job was to find, sign, and guide talent, match songs to singers, and run recording sessions. In other words, doing almost exactly what producers do today. A&R executives still exist, and indeed are among the most important industry people. They're responsible for finding and developing talent, as well as finding songs, matching producers and artists, and generally overseeing projects. But today, most of them don't actually produce the recordings, although many of the better ones come pretty close to producing. Anyway, Snuff worked for Liberty Records, which was then run by its founder and chief executive, Simon Warrenker, the father of former Warner Records and DreamWorks Records president, Lenny Warrenker, its president, Alvin Bennett, and its chief recording engineer, Theodore Keep. Do the first names of these gentlemen sound familiar? Do they remind you of a recording artist on Liberty? Refer to the end of Chapter 11 for the answer, if you can't guess. Snuff, who was one of the smartest business people I ever met, but hid behind this country cornpone, figured out early on that he was making millions of dollars for Liberty while getting a generous but small salary in comparison to what he was generating. So he summoned up all his courage and asked Alvin for a royalty of 1 cent per record. Alvin was not pleased. The radical idea that a person instrumental in creating product could get a royalty? I'm guessing words like outrageous and treason got thrown around between the four-letter daggers. Snuff almost got fired for this request, but he stood his ground and was so valuable to Liberty that he won the point and started a trend that is the reason today's producers get royalties on records. Royalties. Producers get a U.S. royalty in the range of 3% to 4%. Some producers who become superstars in their own right by producing hugely successful records can get 5% or, very rarely, 6%. If there are two producers, such as a track producer and a vocal producer, or a team of two producers, each generally gets half. However, there are some major distinctions between artists' and producers' royalties, and some fine points that will bite you in the butt if you don't know about them. Record 1 royalties. Interestingly, for whatever historical reasons, producers' royalties are computed more favorably than artists' royalties. Specifically, with success, producers are paid for all records sold, meaning recording costs are not charged against their royalties. As you know, recording costs are always charged against artists' royalties. These are called Record 1 royalties because they're paid from the first record, Record 1, that the company exploits. Producers, of course, have to recoup the advances they put in their pocket, but if you think of those advances as a prepayment of royalties, it's the same as getting a royalty on all records. Actually, some superstar producers are paid from Record 1 and don't even have to recoup all of their upfront money, as we'll discuss in a minute. Producers' royalties are paid retroactive to Record 1 after recoupment of recording costs at the net artist rate. What this means in English is that A. Recording costs are recouped at the artist's net rate, the all-in artist rate, after deducting all third-party royalties, which generally means the royalty for the producer, any mixers, samples, etc. B. Until recording costs are recouped, the producer gets no royalties at all, just like an artist. But C. Once recording costs are recouped, the producer gets paid on all monies earned, including those used to recoup recording costs. In other words, once recording costs are recouped, the producer is paid from the first monies earned, called Record 1, from the days when it meant the first record sold. And this payment is retroactive because the company goes back and pays on sales previously made that didn't bear royalties at the time of sale. The concept is easier to see with numbers. Suppose an artist's all-in royalty, artist and producer combined, is 12% a record, and the producer's royalty is 2%. These numbers bear no relationship to reality, but make for easy math. That makes the net royalty 10%, the 12% all-in rate less the 2% producer royalty. Refer to the first chart in the PDF with the headlines Producer's Recording Cost Recoupment Computation and Producer's Royalty Account to see what happens when the album generates $1 million for the record company, meaning the artist earns $100,000, the 10% net royalty multiplied times $1 million. Since the artist's 10% net royalty equals only $100,000, which is short of the $120,000 recording costs, the album's recording costs are unrecouped, and therefore the producer doesn't get any royalties. That's why the producer royalty is zero in that first chart. Now let's assume the company generates $1,200,000, which means the artist earns a total of $120,000 at the 10% net rate. At this point, the $120,000 of recording costs are recouped, and the producer is paid on all the money earned, i.e., retroactively to the first dollar, which is called Record One. Thus, because the producer has a 2% royalty, he or she gets 2% of $1,200,000, or $24,000. Refer to the second chart on the PDF, entitled Producer's Recording Cost Recoupment Computation and Producer's Royalty Account. Did you notice from this second chart that the producer is owed money, but the artist isn't? Stick around. Advances. Producers, like artists, also get advances. These advances fall into two categories. In one corner, weighing in at more than 300 pounds, you've got the urban/hip-hop producers and a handful of superstar pop producers. These folks are often considered as important as, or in some cases, more important than, the artist. Just adding their name to a track can mean hundreds of millions of streams. And in the other corner, we've got rock producers and everybody else. For rock/everybody else, the range of advances is 1. New producers. Anywhere from $0 to $7,500 per master. If the producer is doing an entire album, advances are anywhere from $0 to about $30,000 per album. 2. Mid-level. $10,000 to $15,000 per master, or about $30,000 to $50,000 for the entire album. 3. Superstar. Up to $25,000 per track, and about $150,000 to $200,000 for the whole album. For urban/pop, 1. New producers. Anywhere from $0 to $10,000 per master. 2. Mid-level. $20,000 to $30,000 per master. 3. Superstar. $35,000 to $40,000 per master and up. For urban/pop, these amounts are generally recording funds, meaning they include recording costs, just like the artist funds we discussed back in Chapter 9. The important issue with funds is to allocate how much is treated as recording costs and how much is considered the producer's advance. The higher the recording costs, the worse for the artist. Remember from earlier this chapter, only the advance is charged against producer royalties, because the royalties are payable from Record One after recoupment of the recording costs. Not surprisingly, producers want more allocated to recording costs, and artists want more allocated to advances. By the way, in making this allocation, the actual recording costs have little to do with the discussion. In fact, many of these producers own their own studios, so the actual costs are minimal. The negotiation is really about how much gets charged to the producer's royalties. Other royalty computations. Except for the Record One aspect we discussed earlier in this chapter, producers' royalties are generally calculated the same way as the artists, although audiovisual royalties are different, as noted in the next section. For example, if an artist gets 75% of his or her U.S. rate in England, the producer will get 75% of his or her U.S. producer rate in England. We'll get into the details of how artist royalties are calculated in the next chapter. In situations where the artist gets a percentage of the company's net receipts, such as a license to use a recording in a motion picture, where the artist gets 50% of the fee paid by the motion picture company, the producer gets a pro rata share of the artist's earnings, based on the ratio that the producer's royalty bears to the all-in rate. For example, if the artist's all-in rate is 12% and the producer gets 3%, the producer should get 3/12, 1/4, of the artist's receipts. So if the record company gets $20,000 to use a master in a film and pays $10,000 to the artist, the producer would get $2,500, 3/12, 25% of the $10,000, and the artist would get $7,500, the remaining 9/12. Audiovisual royalties. For audiovisual exploitations, mainly streaming videos these days, producers generally get half of their otherwise applicable rate. The theory is that the master is only half of the product. The video portion is the other half. For example, if the producer had a 3% royalty and YouTube streams the video, the producer would get 1.5% of the revenue. Also, for videos, the payment isn't retroactive to Record One, but rather prospectively after recoupment of video costs. Who hires the producer? At one time, record companies routinely hired the producers. That was in the days when one producer did an entire album, a concept that has almost vanished, since most albums today have multiple producers. Other than a few areas like rock, country, and Oompa Alpine bands. As it became common to have 4, 5, or more producers per album, the companies realized their in-house lawyers were spending so much time negotiating producer deals that it was clogging up their system. So they hit on the brilliant idea that the artist should hire the producer, which has not only shifted the paperwork burden to the artist, but also shifted the financial burden to them. Let's analyze the issues separately. Who actually hires, contracts with, the producer? Since the artist has a direct contractual relationship with the producer is answerable to the artist, and the artist has full control of deciding the terms of the producer's deal. That's the good news if you're an artist. And now for the commercial. You bear the legal fees for negotiating the producer's deal. But wait, there's more bad news. Who pays the producer? As we discussed, in an all-in deal, you're responsible for the producer's royalties, regardless of who actually signs the contract with him or her. This is a much more serious issue than it may look at first glance. For reasons we'll discuss in a minute, the producer may be entitled to royalties before you're recouped under your deal with the record company. Refer back to the last chart we looked at on the PDF. You earned 0 royalties, and the producer was owed $24,000. In other words, this means you owe money to the producer